You're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. That's music from pianist composer Harold Mayburn from his latest recording, 2017 release on Smoke Sessions Records, and it's called To Love and Be Loved. And we just heard him performing the Lee Morgan composition, one called The Gigolo, featured Eric Alexander on tenor sax, Nat Reeves on bass, Freddie Hendrix on the trumpet, and Jimmy Cobb on the drums. We started out the set with music from the 1989 recording called Straight Street by Harold Mayburn and his trio, and we heard his composition Mr. Stitt, and that was Ron Carter on bass and Jack DeJohnette on the drums. And of course, it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Harold Mayburn, pianist, composer, educator. He's a native of Memphis, Tennessee, and he learned to play watching pianist Charles Thomas and Finest Newborn Jr., and playing with Memphis musicians like Frank Strozier, George Coleman, and Booker Little. He moved to Chicago after graduating from high school, and he began exploring the Chicago jazz scene, playing with trombonist Morris Ellis's big band. And while in Chicago, he and Strozier joined with drummer Walter Perkins to form the group the MJT Plus 3. And they later moved to New York, where Mayburn began playing with Harry Sweets Edison. A few weeks later, he joined tenor saxophonist Jimmy Forrest on a session that included the debut of guitarist Grant Green. And in New York, Mayburn acquired a reputation as an outstanding sideman, playing with Lionel Hampton's big band, the Jazz Tet, Betty Carter, Johnny Hartman, Arthur Prysock, Donald Byrd, and Roy Haynes. In 1963, he began a six-week engagement with Miles Davis at the Black Hawk in San Francisco. He also spent time in J.J. Johnson's band. He played briefly with Sonny Rollins and appeared on Blue Note albums by people like Hank Mobley, Jackie McLean, and Lee Morgan. He also worked with Wes Montgomery, Freddie Hubbard, Sarah Vaughan, and Joe Williams. In fact, Harold Mayburn has worked, I guess, with a who's who of jazz. And he began recording as a leader in 1968, and in the early 70s, he worked with Stanley Cowell's piano choir. He also played with people like Clark Terry, Joe Newman, George Benson, Stanley Turrentine. In 1989, he became a part of the Contemporary Piano Ensemble, and Harold Mayburn has also been a longtime educator. In fact, he was an educator at William Patterson University. He's also taught at the Stanford Jazz Workshop. He currently records for Smoke Session Records, and that's just a short version of that. Harold, how you doing, Mr. Mayburn?
Okay, I'm doing fine.
All right. Let's begin, if I can have you sort of begin by talking about your, you know, growing up in Memphis, and what it was like growing up around all of these great musicians. As we said, Finest Newborn Jr., George Coleman, Frank Strozier, Booker Little. What was it like in Memphis at that time, man?
Booker Little, Charles Floyd, Everett Lewis Smith, that was all at Manassas High School. Well, it was wonderful because, believe it or not, even that was during the / Jim Crow segregation days, but it was more jazz going on then than it is now, unfortunately. I just got back from Memphis a couple of weeks ago. Long story short, we had a little southern tour, and it was really nice. So most of the jazz now is at Rhodes College. You know, but it was a good environment because we had to play rhythm and blues, which we didn't want to play. We hated it. I hate to use the word hate because the word hate is too important emotion to use on something to somebody that you don't like anyhow. But anyway, but we didn't realize that that was the greatest part of music because of all the forms of music, the blues is something you can't teach.
Yeah.
You can't teach that. Either you can or you can't. So what we did, the club owner would say, you better stop playing that bebop. You're running my customers out of here. They wanted music that you could dance to. So what we would do, we were creative then. We'd tell the drummer to keep the shuffle beat. And we'd play the Huckabuck, a 35-30. Then once we got through with the head, then we start playing the changes to Cherokee or all the things y'all.
Yeah.
That's how we got over.
Okay.
It would be times, you know, so it was a good environment, but in my case, I wasn't fortunate enough to be able to play Chopin and all that stuff. I started late. See, the piano chose me. I didn't choose it because when guys were studying classical music, like my hero for life, Finest Newborn Jr., I was chopping, picking, pulling, carting. No shame in my game.
I hear you.
So the piano chose me. So mine is strictly a gift from the Most High, you know.
Well, and so I guess you had left Memphis by the time Stax got there, huh?
Oh, yeah, that was after me.
Okay.
So when we came up, our music teacher was Dee Dee Bridgewater's father, who was born in Memphis. Her name is Denise Garrett. She was born May 27, 1950. Her father's name was Matthew Garrett, who was a trumpet player with a perfect embouchure, so that's why he took Booker Little on his wing.
Okay.
So we had a healthy environment. So it was music everywhere, you know, and then they would have stage shows where the bass band would come and the Duke band would come, but that would be like a special kind of thing. You know, and Coltrane would come down with Earl Bostic and people like that. So
yeah,
a lot of great musicians would come through, but all those groups were rhythm and blues groups.
Yeah.
You know, and then you might get a chance to play a tune or two. George Coleman was playing alto with B.B. King's band. So that's the way it was, and it was healthy. And then we had a chance every now and then we could sneak in a tune or two, but most of it was playing blues,
yeah,
rhythm and blues.
Well, tell me the influence of Finest Newborn Jr. on your playing, man.
Man, I know we don't have enough time. We would need 6 hours, but I tell you one thing. When I talk about Finest Newborn Jr., I'm just going to tell you two, PC, because if I don't tell you, most of the jazz fans all over the world, especially, they think everything is okay. Not only think, but it's not okay. Because
yeah,
as Papa Joe Jones used to say, the top is at the bottom and the bottom is at the top. Finest Newborn Jr. plays more piano with his left hand than most of us do with both hands. But he's the most underrated, unappreciated musician that ever played an instrument. Let me just tell you, because I know we don't have enough time. Finneas Newborn Jr. played the tenor saxophone like a saxophone player. He played the trumpet like a trumpet player. No, I'm not making this up. He played vibes like Milt Jackson. In the army band, if you know anything about the two instruments, he played the French horn and the mellophone. He played the bass. The piano was his main instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that hurts me about how they treated him is that Finneas Newborn could have been the biggest egomaniac in the world and backed up. He was the complete opposite. He never said a bad word about anybody because he didn't talk much. Not that he couldn't talk or he was an imbecile. He just didn't talk. So he never put anybody down.
Okay.
James Williams got him to talk more than anybody. I think I knew Finneas 51 years, and he said 51 words to me. You know, and if you tried to get him to put somebody, like somebody tried to get him to put Cecil Taylor down, one of my dearest friends, God bless you, Cecil Taylor,
yeah,
you know, because of his style. So Finneas paused for a minute and said, well, that's some obscure Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn music. If you read through that, that's all he said. That's not a put-down.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, so the world really dogged him, and it was a shame. And I was in Memphis, and I told them they should go to Booker Washington, because he went to both high schools, Booker Washington and Manassas. And I said they should go to Booker Washington and tell the music department to start a scholarship fund in his name.
Yeah.
And even further, somebody with some money should go to the city council or the governor or somebody and build a Finneas Newborn Jr. school in his name, because there's nobody like Finneas Newborn Jr.
The
great Oscar Peterson, I'm going to be brief,
okay,
who plays at a place in Bern, Switzerland called Mary Ann's. The club owner is the trumpet player. He said, Oscar, tell me something. Who are your two favorite piano players? Oscar Peterson paused. He said, I tell them, Finneas Newborn Jr.
Yeah.
So there are only a few people that backed up Finneas. Mr. Hank Jones, my other hero, Mr. Ahmad Jamal,
yeah,
Mr. Thomas Flanagan, Mr. Walter Davis Jr., naturally Stanley Cowell, Mogul Miller, James Williams, Don Brown, people like that, and
yeah,
Bobby Lyle. But it was just a joy just to be around him. And Finneas taught me, not because he would say, take this finger and put it there. He would teach me by playing, so I had to learn fast because
yeah,
he played everything fast. You know, in other words, wherever the tempo was, that's the way he played, so I had to use my ears. So Finneas Newborn, trust me, there will never be another Finneas Newborn Jr. And the main thing is a lot of guys practice the two hands, which is good. Finneas didn't have to practice the two hands simultaneously. He just put his hands, and it came out. J.L. Wilson, who played in Jimmy Lawson's band, asked him, how did he do that? He said, well, I got tired of playing the Hammond in the key of C, so he just started playing everything through different keys.
Well, now, Harold, you pronounce his name, you know, several different ways, Finneas and Finneas. So how do we really pronounce it?
Finneas Newborn Jr. But
okay,
when he got to New York, you know, like Tony Bennett's name wasn't Tony Bennett, Bob Hope had him change it. And, you know, show business. John Wayne's name was Marion Morrison, something like that. But for Hollywood or for the press, he became John Wayne.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how that happened. The agent said, well, let's call him Finneas.
Finneas.
But he was born Finneas Newborn Jr.
Okay.
Whiteville, Tennessee, which is about 35 minutes or so from Memphis.
Because I remember James, I heard James Williams talk about him, and he emphasized that, you know, he said, it's not Phineas, it's Finest.
He's right.
All right. All right. Now, tell me one of the musicians from Memphis that I really think is underrated in addition to Finest Newborn Jr. is Frank Strozier. Tell me a little bit about Frank. I always liked him.
My closest friend, because without Frank Strozier, you wouldn't be talking to me now about music, because when we were kids, he had the motivation then. Frank Strozier, without a doubt, and it's funny because I was at school yesterday doing a music jury. All the saxophone players now want to know, what is Strozier done? Frank Strozier is the most unique alto saxophonist since Charlie Parker. Let me see, you can take that to the bank. Don't take my word. Go on YouTube and download Get Out of Town by Cole Porter, Alive in L.A. with Alvin Nelson Big Band playing I Remember Bird.
Yeah,
nobody
yeah.
plays like Frank Strozier.
Yeah.
His technique is deceiving because he's playing such heat. The only person who would remind you of him probably would be Joe Henderson.
Okay.
Those are the kind of things he's playing. But Frank Strozier, he was a clarinet major. Like I said, we were all in the same high school band together.
Okay.
But he just got fed up. He said he got tired of dealing with Reeds, R-E-E-D-S. You know, everybody dealt with Reeds, Charlie Parker. But I said, no, he got tired of dealing with Reeds, R-E-A-D-S, reading in the paper, because John Coltrane practiced 25 hours a day. Jimmy Heath said it was only 24. Booker Little practiced 18 hours a day. Frank Strozier practiced 14. So when we were working a lot, he was motivated. So he just got tired of chasing so-called fame, because Frank wasn't the kind of guy who would go out and shake hands. He wasn't anti-social or anything, but he just felt that if you practice, you should be rewarded for what you did, you know.
Ben
West used to call him all the time. Now, wait a minute. This is one of the old-timers calling Frank Strozier to compliment him. Coltrane asked him questions about the saxophone when he was 21 years old. As Curtis Fuller say, I was there.
You can
take that to just not hearsay. Charlie Parker's ex-wife, Doris Parker, said to Frank, Charles would love you, meaning Bird, because he's very unique. Nobody plays like him on alto.
Yeah.
Plus, his alto sound is a cross between alto and tenor.
And you know that tune, I Remember Bird, with Oliver Nelson's big band, that's one of my favorite tunes.
Well, go back and listen to that, and the point proves itself, you know.
All right.
So I haven't spoken to him since 2010 when my wife departed, and he offered his condolences and stuff. After that, George Coleman and I, we haven't heard from him since. But he's still alive and well. He's up there in Providence somewhere.
All right. Well, how is George Coleman doing? I heard that, you know, his health was kind of, you know, was going bad on him. How's he doing?
It's no worse than mine or yours or anybody else. He's been dealing with, you know, see, George Coleman used to go to the gym. He's one of those kind of people that whatever he did it 200%. He used to go to the gym, and I bench press, professional bench presser, you know. So as we up in age now, I spoke to him day for year. He's doing fine. He's just moving a little slow because lower back pain.
Okay.
But that's just some natural stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's still playing. I'm going to play with him one night in July. So he's doing fine, you know.
All right. So that's why he, you know, whenever I saw a picture of him, he was pretty big guy. So he was a weightlifter, huh?
Right. He did a lot of weightlifting.
Okay.
And, you know, as you grow on later on in life, you have to pay the price for the things you do. You know what I mean?
I'm paying that price now, man. I know what you mean.
Hey, you know what I mean? I'm 82, and I still have aches and pains and certain things. I try to get out and walk at least 35 minutes a day because walking still one of the best things you can do.
Yeah.
You know, eat right and eat plenty of fruit and vegetables. I found me some pumpkin seeds. I went to this health food store. They got some where you got to break the shell, but they got some places you go where they're not. You just eat them out the bag.
Okay, okay.
So, you know.
Well, tell me about your time in Chicago. How does Chicago contribute to your development as a musician?
Oh, great, because when Frank and I left 1954 August, I went up there because my sister told me, said, if you come, you can go to the Conservatory of Music, which is where Booker Little Frank went. But when I got there, the money was kind of a little tight. She said, well, look, you here, why don't you stay here and see what you can do, which is the greatest thing for me, because this music is not from the college. This music comes from the University of the Streets.
Yeah.
College is just an enhancement, you know. You know, I've been in William Patterson 37 years, so
yeah.
I had a chance to be around and meet all the musicians who were very great, gracious to me and for me. And the first greatest genius I met was Bill Lee, Spike Lee's dad. One of the greatest all-around geniuses you'll ever meet.
He is an outstanding musician, yeah.
Nobody, the whole family ain't nothing but a bunch of geniuses. See, Spike and I born on the same day, March 20th.
Okay.
So the whole Lee family, and Bill Lee had a sister named Consuela Lee Moorhead. Well,
you know, she lived down here in Alabama. I met her, man.
She was a harmonic genius.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody liked her. Now, you know, Don discovered Herbert. Herbert's like my little brother.
Okay.
But Don Bird was talking about Consuela. Nobody liked her. So when I heard Bill Lee practicing in the practice room, fast forward, I never heard chords like that. So what kind of chords are those he playing? So after 2 weeks, he let me know who he was. And he said, you like this? There's a blind pianist named Chris Anderson who taught Herbert Hancock.
Okay.
That's for the record, not Bill Evans, not taking that from Bill, because Bill learned from Chris Anderson.
Okay.
Then I met another pianist who just passed out in Denver. His name was Billy Wallace, who was from Milwaukee, moved to Chicago like Willie Pickens. He taught me how to carve. And then naturally, Mr. Ahmad Jamal, one of a kind. Nobody like him.
Okay.
So that's how I got over. So then one thing led to another, and then Walter Perkins, Baby Sweeks, said, hey, little brother, called brother, said, we got this group, me and you and Bobby Crashaw. Bob Crashaw was a garbage man. He used to like for me to say garbage man, because there was no such thing as sanitation, man. It was garbage man. And Crashaw used to love it. His wife got a little mad. Crashaw said, Baron, he said, Baron, tell him what I did. So when Walter Perkins got the group, he said, we're going to have little brother Frank Shoji and Bobby Bryant, who was the original trumpet player, and me and you, and Bobby Crashaw. So I said, that garbage man? I didn't know he played bass. So Chicago was a very ubiquitous town because of the fact that we had to play all kinds of music, all styles.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you played with Eddie Harris wouldn't fit with Johnny Griffin because Johnny Griffin was playing all up-tempo stuff like Max Roach.
Yeah.
That's where George Coleman hang out. Eddie Harris was playing what they call funk. I hate that word, but that's what he was playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they played with all those great singers like Larez Alexandria, Lurleen Hunter, Paula Greer, a whole bunch of people. You know, so that was one of the greatest cities for me. It helped me a lot because that's how I learned, as you said before, playing with Morris Ellis' big band.
Yeah.
Morris Ellis went to Howard with Benny Golson and Big Eddie Jones, so they were classmates.
Okay.
Well, so it was a great city.
Do you think if you had been able to attend the conservatory, would that have changed anything about how you play the piano now?
Well, let's go back. If I had listened to Mr. Bobby Jones, who was the music teacher, and Frank and I and Booker Lou, we were clowning around. She said, "Hell, maybe in one of these days you're going to regret that." And the reason why, I would have been a great sight reader, and I would have been able to do jingles like Herbert Hancock, Big Hammer, and Hank Jones, where you go and read a 20-second piece of music for an automobile.
Yeah.
That's like a Chopin etude.
Okay, okay.
So to go back, sure, if I'd gone there, I'd have been more exposed to the Chopin etude, but I used to practice at the Chicago Conservatory, so a lot of that stuff rubbed off on me. So people used to say, Mr. Mayburn, how long have you been playing Scriabin? I said, I don't even know how to spell Scriabin. But when you're in a particular environment, if it's good, it's going to be positive. If it's bad, it's going to be negative. So sure, I would have been a better complete all-around musician, play Chopin etude, because Chopin is my favorite composer from that period, then Ravel and Debussy.
Okay.
But I think I did pretty good.
I think you did too, man.
Under the circumstances.
I think you did.
Plus, I'm still learning. You never stop learning. I told Ahmad Jamal once, my hero for life, I said, Ahmad, you, man, you sound so good, you don't need to practice. I knew what he was going to say. He pointed his finger. He said, let me tell you something, Harold Mayburn. Everybody needs to practice.
Yeah.
I knew what he was going to say, but I was just kind of messing with him.
Yeah. Well, then when you went to New York, okay, you started playing with people like Betty Carter, you know, Miles Davis. Tell me about your time with Miles Davis. What was that like, that the period you spent with Miles, man?
Well, the time with Miles Davis was wonderful. It was different because at the time I wasn't thinking about playing with Miles Davis. I wanted to play with Clifford Brown and Max Roach. But here again, the gear came to me. What happened? The last gig he had in Philadelphia, Wynton Kelly, my hero, J.J. Johnson, Sonny Stitt, Paul, and Jimmy Carr, Miles didn't show up for the gig. So they said, okay, the heck with it. But now he's got this gig for 6 weeks on the West Coast. So when I got home, I was out with Roy Haynes. My wife said, call Betty Carter. She got 2 weeks for you in Berlin. And she said, somebody named Prophet. His name was Richard Jennings. He was a great poet. He used to do paintings of bird. And he said, Prophet called and said, call Miles Davis, because they knew I played with all the singers in Berlin. That's how I did that album, Alpha Rue, because I had an affinity for playing with singers.
Yeah,
the best record Betty Carter ever made was called Inside Betty Carter.
I got that, yeah. My favorite thing.
That's me, Bob Crashaw, Roy McCurdy.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So when Miles called, I already knew Miles from Chicago, MJT plus three, so he said, what you doing? I said, well, you know, I just got back. I got a gig. I need somebody. So I said, okay. So we talked, and he said, he said, do you know trombone player? I said, no, I know an alto player. He said, oh, I said, Frank Shores. He said, what's Frank doing? I told him. So I called Frank. Frank reluctantly didn't want to take the gig, but I figured I was on it. George Coleman was on it because George had been hired, yeah. Ron Carter, myself. So I asked him about the money. I said, what's the money talking about? He said, what you want? I said, can I get $250? Because that's what they were paying at the time, $250 a week, which was a lot of money. He said, you got it. So he came by Birdland to hear me. He said he had called two piano players, the last two on the list, myself and another piano player who shall remain nameless. And he more or less said we were the two saddest suckers. You can translate your own.
Yeah.
In other words, if he could have not have called me, hey, wasn't no shame in my game because I never pretend to be anything but just do the best I could with what I had.
Yeah.
So he came and heard me, and he threw a punch at me. That meant I was okay. So he gave me the information I got. So we had a wonderful time, man, because he came to the gig every night on time. Let's play some music, you know. And when I left, the reason why he let me go is because he said in the book I wasn't right for the band. And man, what it was, you know, when they were playing that mode, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I didn't understand those clusters, you know, where you play an A minor chord and you play a C and a B with your thumb. That's a classical device. That's impressionistic kind of stuff. And I didn't understand it. And I look back on it now, that's all I play. I told Mark Miller, I said, you know, I didn't understand. He said, Mr. Maven, a whole lot of cats didn't understand that concept
there.
Now, that's one of the contributions that Bill Evans did make, you know, with the clusters and stuff like that. But we had a wonderful time, and when I left the band and I got with Stanley Turchin and I did that date, he said, you got your stuff together now. So he really always inspired me, you know.
Okay.
So it was a very learning experience for me.
Well, you know, you mentioned playing with Betty Carter, and on that album, Inside Betty Carter, which, like I said, that's one of my favorite albums. The tune My Favorite Things has always been one of my favorite tunes. And I've talked with several other pianists who've played with Betty Carter. I've talked with Mulgrew. I've talked with Benny Green. And, and they all said that playing with Betty was like an education in itself.
It was. It was very challenging.
And in fact, I've seen her, you know, live. I saw her live several times, and I, you know, saw her where she would start, she would count out a tempo, and the band wasn't quite hitting the tempo. She would tell them stop and start, you know, start again, you know.
Oh, yeah. It was a challenging gig.
Okay.
And she would sing those ballads very, very slow.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tell piano players now all over the world, if you want to learn how to be a great accompanist, play with singers.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your time with Lee Morgan, one of my favorite musicians.
Oh, man,
Lee Morgan.
He was like a little brother to me. I was with him until he took his last breath, as you probably know. I wish I could have been somewhere else, but that wasn't my call. That was the call of the Most High. Lee Morgan, it was nothing phony about Lee Morgan. He was misconstrued a lot of times because they said he was cocky. He wasn't cocky. He was just sure of himself.
Yeah.
And see, if Lee Morgan was here now, he would look here. What can I say? Nobody went out playing now. First of all, he was a natural high note trumpet player. And he could sight read the Brandenburg Concerto like he was reading the Memphis Gazette. You know, he took the test at Juilliard just to show him he could do it, and he didn't even go.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's nobody like him, you know.
Okay.
And because, first of all, his two teachers were Clifford Brown and Dizzy Gillespie. Hello, how you going? It gets no better than that.
Yeah.
But he was very generous, man. We used to talk a lot, and he always supported. When we were rehearsing for Hank Mobley's Day Dipping, Lee was like a little kid, even the night he died with the snow. Oh, neighbor, look at all that snow. Which little did we know later on would be his demise because the snow was so high, the ambulance couldn't get to him.
Yeah.
But he would say, ooh, listen to Mayburn Cobb. And he told Alpha Lyon, he said, I want Mayburn on my next day. I said, oh, yeah, Lee was a dictator without being dictatorial, you know.
Yeah.
He just said, this is what I want, and they respected it. And that was the Gigolo, which is my favorite date because
it is,
that's the only record I ever recorded with Wayne Short. I played with Wayne all around New York. That's the only documentation. So Lee was brilliant, man. He was a super-duper genius.
What?
He used to sit in with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Eugene Normandy would say, let that kid sight read the first trumpet book. Nobody's like Lee Morgan.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really pleased that you chose the Gigolo on your latest release because, you know, it seems to me that a lot of people don't play the Gigolo. And there's been several, like, Lee Morgan tribute albums that have come out. The most recent one was by Terrell Stafford.
Terrell Stafford, who I'm going to play with him about a month from now. Yeah.
And I asked him, well, you know, why didn't you play the Gigolo? I said, I don't hear people play the Gigolo, you know.
It's a tricky little tune. And what happened, see, when I did that To Love and Be Loved, it was supposed to be a quartet day just with myself and Eric Alexander,
yeah.
who is my best student in 37 years at William Patterson College, bar none. And this young man is so brilliant. We're going to Chicago tomorrow. I tell people, with Eric Alexander, don't get mad, get even, because nobody likes him.
yeah.
He took two lessons from George Coleman, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I like it.
Nobody can outplay him. When you hear two notes of Eric Alexander, you know that's the sound. First of all, whatever you play, you got to have a sound. When you hear two notes of Phineas, that's him.
Yeah.
Ahmad Jamal, same with Hank Jones, you see. So it was going to be a quartet day, so Paul Stash, who's the genius up at Smoke, he said, the gigolo and stuff. I said, well, look, man, you can't play the gigolo without a trumpet. So that's when I called Freddie Hendricks,
all right.
who is my former student.
Okay.
And that's how that happened.
Well, you know, and speaking of Lee, you know, you were on his last recordings, and to me, it seemed like, you know, he was kind of going in a different direction. And
you got a good ear. You must be a musician.
No, but I've been listening for a long time, man. But
he was going in, we getting ready to go into a different direction.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. Okay, I you know, would have loved to hear what he would have done after that. And then, of course, the Live at the Lighthouse session.
Everybody, even Lou Dawson gives it, yeah, your boy sounds wonderful. He gives it, of course. That was an exciting time, an exciting piece of
yeah,
music. And,
yeah.
And with the Beehive, I wrote that for a club in Chicago where Clifford Brown, Bird, everybody played, called the Beehive. So that's why that
okay,
song,
okay.
you know.
And I'm from Southern California, so I spent a lot of time at the Lighthouse. In fact, you know, at the time that you guys came, I had just missed you guys
right.
At the Lighthouse. But anyway, we talked about your recording as a leader. Of course, your most recent recordings are on Smoke Sessions Records. And the one before this, I want to talk a little bit about that one, as you said, the one where you featured singers.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that recording, man, Afro Blue.
Well, to fast forward, like I said, at Birdland, I had all the singing gigs. I played there with Betty Carter. See, the old-timers, and I said old-timers with respect, because now I'm the old-timer. But Hank Jones, all them cats, they wouldn't say anything to you, but they would come by and listen and scope you out. So after I played with Betty Carter, then I played with Irene Reed, I played with Johnny Hartman, I played with Dakota Staten, I played with Ernestine Allison, I played with Gloria Lynn, she sang Watermelon Man and A-flat, I played with Arthur Prysock, and I couldn't make the set night, so I hired a little guy named Herbie Hancock and paid him $18. Hello, that was a lot of money then, because I had a $25 gig. So Paul Stash is always trying, he said, maybe I got an idea for the next one, let's use some singers. I said, Stash, we can't use singers, man. I said, because you rehearsed 3 hours with a singer for a 25-minute gig.
Yeah.
So he said, okay. So he started telling me the people who had come aboard, you know, Alexis Cole, who was a brilliant young singer.
Yeah, she has a nice CD out now.
College.
Yeah.
Kurt Elling, Gregory Porter, Jay Monheit. The last one to come aboard was Nora Jones. So what happened? So Paul felt I could do it. So we went in the studio. I had a concept. And here's why I say that record is very misconstrued. That record should have won a Grammy, a Nammy, a Tammy, but it ended up being Silent Night, because so that the listener would know, I'm no genius in anything, but I had a thought concept about what to do, and we didn't rehearse at all. No rehearsal. We went in the studio, and one by one, I said, zip, zip, zip. So when Nora Jones came in, she called me and told me, she said, let's do Don't Misunderstand, just the two of us, and Fools Rush In. So I said, well, how are we going to do Fools Rush In? And I do Frank Sinatra, who I dearly love and respect. So I told Joe Farnsworth, for Fools Rush In, put the punch out of beat on, and that's how that record came about.
Okay.
And I would play little snippets on the piano, and Eric Alexander would notate certain things and give it to Jeremy Pelt and Steve Sherway. They all did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
And the song You Needed Me, Ann Murray, Nora Jones was supposed to sing that. I had her sing that with her laid-back concept, you know, but Stash felt no. So then I told Eric, we call him Big Red Affection, you write it down because I wanted it to be played. So Kurt Elling had done his part, and I started playing down. I cried up to him. So Kurt Elling comes up to the piano, true story, and starts singing. I said, hey, man, roll the tape. And that's how that happened.
Okay.
And I'm quite proud of the record because, like I said before, we did that record with no rehearsal, you know.
Yeah.
And it was kind of quietly ignored. But, you know, hey, you can't let that get you down because, hey, that's the way life is.
Well, you know, sometimes I think about the Grammys, and sometimes I kind of wonder about the Grammys and whether or not the people who do that, you know, are really listening to music. And a lot of times it becomes kind of just a popularity
It is popularity.
Contest, you know.
It is popularity because the last time jazz was highly represented on that show was years ago. I think it was in 1994 when Joe Williams, Sarah Vaughan, Wintermont said it was full-fledged jazz. It's like they said, okay, let's give them this. Now, that's enough of that. That's why we have to go to Japan and Europe, yeah. Which is my favorite country, because the people, especially in Tokyo, they love and appreciate and respect the jazz musicians.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And they'll spend $100 music charge to come hear you play at the Cotton Club, which is where I play, 250 people. And that's not including food. That's just to sit down.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So they appreciate the music, you know. And just so you, so the listeners will know, jazz musicians are the smartest people on the planet. No offense to anybody. That's just the way it is.
Okay.
Now, you know, away from the piano, you know, Dr. Don Byrd spoke. We had four earned degrees, a bachelor, yeah. A doctorate, a master's, a law degree, and he was an airline pilot. Dr. Willie Ruff up at Yale, just yeah. The guy, speaks seven languages. And after English, the Chinese language is the number one. If you know anything about the language, the Japanese people get a lot of their derivatives in the way they write from the Japanese language, and so forth and so on. And Josh Redman has 2 degrees, you know, yeah. Yale and Harvard. I could go. Kenny Garrett speaks fluent Japanese. He's studying the Korean language now. Keith Jarrett did the Goldberg Variations on the harpsichord. I could go on and
yeah,
on and
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
That's why Bill Russell hung around Cannonball.
Yeah.
Because Bill Russell's best friend was Cannonball. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's best friend was Freddie Hubbard. Hello.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I could go on and on
yeah,
and on.
Yeah.
Mr. Ahmad Jamal, when he was 11 years old, he was playing Litz Etudes with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Hello. You see, so I could go on. So that's why everybody's trying to act and talk like the jazz, because we taught the whole world to rap.
Yeah.
Is that the new Louis Jordan, Cab Calloway were rapping back in the 40s and 50s without using vulgar language.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's nothing new about rap. I'm not putting it down, but that's why those guys, they can't write music. That's why they have to sample your stuff.
Yeah.
So every day I wake up, I say, dear Lord, thank you for making me a jazz musician.
I hear you. Well, tell me, and I mentioned this before I'm talking with Mr. Hill Mayburn, and you know, I mentioned, of course, that you were a part of Stanley Cowell's piano choir, as
right.
well as the Contemporary Piano Ensemble
right.
with Jeff Keyser and Mulgrew and Donald Brown, James
right.
Williams. How do you enjoy playing with all piano ensembles, and how is that different than playing
well,
with a traditional band?
Stanley Cowell's piano choir, that was really challenging because we didn't have any rhythm section.
Okay.
Only we had hand rhythm, like a tambourine, but we didn't have any drums, so everybody had to carry their own rhythm. Like, that's where Phineas Newborn come in. See, like, you got two basic schools of piano most people don't know. It's Bud Powell and Nat King Cole. Hello, I said that. They said, what? Yeah. So see, Phineas taught me, Phineas was percussive, Oscar Peterson, McCoy Tyner, Monty
yeah.
Alexander, how to carry your rhythm with your right hand when you solo on, where your left hand becomes incidental, you see. So it was a challenge with Stanley because we had to carry our own rhythm, and some of the guys' rhythm was a little bit shaky. No offense, because, hey, nobody knows everything, including me, you know.
Yeah.
But I've always had good rhythm, and I tell you, told the students, you learn how to play good time by playing the boogie-woogie and stride. Because when you can play stride as a pianist, that helps you get your rhythm together.
Okay.
So with Stanley, that was great for me. Then we moved on to James Williams' Contemporary, which was dedicated to Phineas. That was even greater because we had four pianists,
yeah.
and rhythm section. Jeffrey Keyser, who was like my little brother. Jeffrey Keyser is more like Phineas than any piano player that ever lived because
okay.
he just automatically conceived that concept. Then I was instrumental in creating a group, you might have heard about it, in Japan called 100 Gold
yeah.
Fingers of Jazz. That started with me. I was the one who recommended those pianists for
okay.
that group.
Okay.
You see. So it was always a challenge because when you play with piano players, you have to know how to stay out of each other's way.
Yeah.
You see. So I've been blessed in the sense that I've had a chance to do some diverse things with a lot of different people. You know, and I heard you running that down, man. I didn't realize I had been involved with those many people, but I have. The
yeah.
only people that I didn't know, I didn't see my hero in person, Nat King Cole. I didn't see Art Tatum in person. I did see Bird, but any other names you call, it's a good chance that I knew them,
yeah.
played with them, and I recorded with them. Like
yeah.
Grant Green's first recording was on All the Gin Is Gone, Jimmy Forrest.
Yeah, and I've heard that recording.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you mentioned, of course, that you've been at William Patterson for 37 years now.
37 years.
But at the same time, you know, you said that, you know, jazz is a music from the streets.
Oh, yeah, from so, the university of the streets. So, Earl Garner didn't go to school. West Montgomery didn't go to school. Monte Alexander plays the piano like he's been around. Arthur Rubenstein, he didn't go to school.
Yeah, yeah. So, so in your opinion, then, what is the benefit of these jazz programs? I mean, I guess I know the answer to this already. Students can't be a jazz musician just studying in the school, right?
No, you got to do you got to do certain classical things and other parts of music. But the main benefit is what we do at William Patterson. I said my other professor, Professor Bill Shalap, who's a piano harmonic genius, is we teaching them about the Great American Songbook. See, because the Great American Songbook, first of all, if you learn how to play those melodies right, that's a lifetime study. And most of these young kids, they don't have a clue. And even some of the guys that's older than them don't understand. Like, for example, on my new CD, we did I Get a Kick Out of You, but we didn't do it in the traditional way. So a lot of people here, they said, that's not what I did was the verse. There was a man named Albert Einstein made a statement. He said, imagination is more important than knowledge. He said, knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. What he was saying was that knowledge without imagination, you're limiting yourself.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest proponents of that is Mr. Ahmad Jamal. He took a tune like Music, Music, which was the corniest song on the hit parade, and reconceptualized this and made it hip, so to speak, as they say.
Yeah.
So your imagination, see, they even wrote a song about it called Imagination, Jimmy Van Heusen. So that's the main thing we teach in those kids in school.
Okay.
Number two, most piano players all over the world got more technique than I'll ever have. But it's two things. All these piano players all over the world, they can't comp. They don't know how to comp. And they can't play an introduction to a ballad without playing the melody.
Yeah.
So my work is cut out for me. It's a pleasure because there's so much they don't know. And here again, we're teaching them at William Patterson, the Great American Songbook. That was a young man who just got what they call the Genius Award, the MacArthur 500. His name is Tyshawn Sawyer. You may have heard the name. He has perfect pitch. He plays piano. He plays drums. He plays guitar. He plays trombone. He has total recall. He has a photograph memory and everything.
Okay.
So we got a good school out there, and I'm proud of that school because they used to laugh at that school when I started. They said, where you going? I'm going to Manus. Right on. Where you going, Juilliard? Right on.
Yeah.
Where you going? William Powell. They don't laugh no more.
No, they don't. They don't.
Eric Alexander, Joe Farnsworth, Bill Stewart, Carl Allen, Jonathan Blake Jr., Jermaine Brown, Roxy Carr, Freddie Hendrix.
Yeah.
The list, these are all my former students.
Okay.
Now they're tearing the doors down trying to get them because the secret is we're teaching 2-5-1. See, you're not going to outplay Charlie Palmer. See, a lot of these guys, they're trying to get hipper than Bird. You're not going to be hipper than Bird.
Yeah.
You start with Bird, Lou Armstrong got it started. But Art Tatum and Charlie Parker took it over. They're in a class by themselves.
Yeah. Okay.
Rachmaninoff said the greatest piano player he ever heard in his life was Art Tatum. He didn't say in jazz, Oscar Peterson said, I've been telling you, dumb as that. So that's why I say, you know, so college is just an enhancement to, you know, to round out the stuff you already know.
But you know, you still, in fact, I interviewed Billy Childs, another piano player.
That's another genius.
And we were talking about this, and he was saying, you know, that there's not the kind of opportunities, because he mentioned how he really learned how to play jazz by being in Freddie Hubbard's band.
Right, exactly.
But he said that, you know, there really aren't that many opportunities now for musicians to be mentored like that. Would you agree?
I agree.
Okay.
You know, because when I came up at the right time because the night I sat in with Harrison Session at Birdland, I had $5,000 in my pocket. And I guess you could say I was African-American rich. You can trash that later on. That was a lot of money then because the flea bag hotels were $10 a week. The Four Seasons was like a $150 a week.
Yeah.
Now the Four Seasons is $750 a night, so I had a lot of money.
Okay.
So when I sat in that night at Birdland, and the admission was, I thought it was $1, it was 99 cents to get in. Can you believe that? It was cover charge. It was 10 piano players in the house, including Quincy Jones.
Okay.
Who had a record date with Dinah Washington the next day, and for the big band, Quincy's fee would have been about $500. What? That was a lot of money. You see, so I made up my mind, and when I came to New York, I was going to hustle, give my cards out or whatever, and be on the scene, because if you hung out during that time, you could get a gig just by being on the scene at the right time.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, so there was a lot of mentoring going on. Even though guys were strung out then, they still had integrity and they could play, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We shared a lot of, nobody put anybody down. And if you didn't want to use drugs, then nobody tried to twist your arm. It was about the music and about the bandstand.
Well, do you think is that still a problem like it had been in the past?
Not
drugs.
As much then, because the outlet is not the same. Because during that time, there were places you could go on the main venue and you'd get a chance to sit in. Now it's not quite like that.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but here again, the older guys would come and support the younger guys, because we would live for the day where we could have a Monday night at Berlin. That was big time, where you'd lead your own group. In other words, it would be like the Max Roach quintet without Max, or the Art Blakey quintet without Art, you know.
Yeah.
So the young cats would get a chance to show off on Monday nights, and Cannonball and Train and all of them would come and check us out. So it was a lot of camaraderie. Now, back then it was competition without animosity. Now it's competition with animosity, and I say, how dare them? Most of them cats, if you take 10 piano players, some of them, and put them together, 10 of them couldn't play the right melody to I Get Along Without You Very Well. And that's no put down, because nobody knows everything. But then we were very serious about the music.
Yeah.
When I left Memphis, Tennessee, being around Charles Summers, Phineas Newborn, another two-handed pianist that went to Manassas, named Evans Bradshaw. When I got to Chicago, I was 18 years old. I still knew how great Hank Jones was then. So age has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You got to do your homework, and you got to be serious. And I tell them, the only shortcut to success is hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got to be, you. I tell them, if you're not going to be greedy for the music like Coltrane, you better be very hungry. And that's what's missing in a lot of guys. A lot of these guys want to take the shortcut. You can't do that, you know.
Okay.
And here again, like I said, if you play the piano, you better get your stuff together, because you can't have, because if you get on one of them bandstands, like a Commodore Clay, who I love dearly, and she had a great respect for me, and I feel honored, you better, because she's going to be singing the great American songbook.
Yeah, yeah.
And you got to know what you're doing.
Yeah, and of course, she was a piano player herself, right?
She said Vaughn would tell me, Herbie, anybody, get up and check this. Oh, yes, sir. I'll never forget it. I had the displeasure doing 5 concerts with Sarah Vaughn. Long story short, because of Bob James, the book, she had 70 pieces of music in it. Bob James said, hey, learn these 20 tunes, which is a lot of tunes for 5 days. I got in the woodshed at 5 o'clock Thursday evening, didn't come out till 5 o'clock Friday morning. Yeah, I took a little break. I get to the house, and Sarah Vaughn is sitting on a stool eating a bagel. So I said, well, where are the rest of the guys? And she said, oh, no, honey, it's just me and you. Man, I wanted to fall through the floor. And the first song she called was, she said, let's do number 23. Which wasn't on the list. That was Poor Butterfly with the verse. But I nailed it, because I had gone through that whole book for about 8 or 9 hours.
Okay.
So playing for singers has been a wonderful thing for me, you know. But here again, with the young piano players, you better get yourself together so you can learn how to play for singers and learn how to transpose. Bill Shiloh was talking about how George Coleman and I would transpose through the keys and do things like that.
Yeah.
Well, we've been playing together for so long, it's become second nature. And not only that, with George, he might call a tune that we haven't played in 50 years, and he remembers it, and he's expecting me to remember. So the bandstand is a challenge, and as Amma Jamal said once, everybody can't share that bandstand. That's why I tell the young guys, don't come around begging to sit in, because you might get yourself embarrassed. You know, let people invite you on the bandstand.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like you begging somebody to invite themselves by the house for dinner. They said, man, we ain't invited to the house again. And they said, okay, man, come on by the house. You get to the house, they got a big old pig up there. They got some horses. They got some duck feet. They got some chicken thighs. And you say, what are you doing? I don't know. He just said, well, you invited yourself to their house. Let them invite you. Then they said, what would you like to eat?
Yeah.
So that's the way the bandstand is.
Okay.
So, but there are some young bright lights out here now doing some wonderful things on piano, like two of my former students, Chris Pattersall, Billy Tesh, and Dill, who drives airplane. He's an airline pilot. You know, Kristen Sands, Sullivan Fordon, Eric Lewis, they call him Elu. So there's some bright young piano players out here doing some wonderful things.
Well, you mentioned Bill Charlap, and I was just reading a piece about Bill Charlap, and he was talking about the Great American Songbook, and he also was talking about how, you know, for him, He said he's not a composer. He said, you know, I just want to interpret the American Songbook, and I want to, you know, I want to play these tunes. He said, but I'm not a composer. Is it important for, you know, a musician to be a composer?
Well, I think it's something that can happen to you, or you choose to do it. But I understand what he's saying. He doesn't really compose a lot of songs, but he's mastered the Great American Songbook, yeah, because he grew up in a musical family. His father's name was Moose Shalap, who wrote music in Never Never Land and Tinkerbell and all that. And he wrote a song that Joe Egan used to sing, I Was Telling About You, My Da 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 Da. And his mother's name is Sandra Stewart, who still performs. She's a vocalist. So he grew up in it. That's why he knows that Great American Songbook inside and out, every melody right. He knows all the lyrics and everything.
Okay.
You see. So now, in his case, he's mastered the Great American Songbook, and that's what guys are trying to play now. Everybody's trying to come back and understand that Great American Songbook, because, you know, people say, well, if you had to go to an island and you could only take one record, well, I'd like to sneak in two, or Phineas Newborn, I would just say, no, you can't take me one. What would it be? Well, I come to the conclusion, for me, it would be Charlie Parker with Strings, and Eric Alexander said, Al Foster said the same thing.
Yeah.
I would take Charlie Parker with Strings and listen to Bird play those melodies and cry, you know, because there's nobody like Bird.
Well, you know, you did a recording on High Note Records, a tribute to Sammy Davis Jr. Why Sammy? What does Sammy mean to you, man?
I'm glad you said it, because JJ would say, I would say, why not Sammy? See, here again, with us so-called African-Americans, not all of us, we've been duped, brother. You know, like, Sammy Davis was one of the greatest.
Oh, yeah.
Not one, the greatest, you know, nobody like him. But see, a lot of black people, I'm just telling you where it is, no shame in my game, looked at Sammy as an Uncle Tom.
What? Yeah.
He was anything but. Sammy said, well, look, I can't hit a home run standing on the outside of Yankee Stadium. All them brothers and sisters have, they paid dues, so some of these knuckleheads can make these millions of dollars that they're making.
Yeah, yeah.
Sammy Davis was classy. He played every instrument. Jimmy Owens told me once, he took his trumpet and played that. He played vibe. So that's why I said, you know, I tell you what happened. I'm going to try to be brief. We were doing 100 Gold Fingers of Jazz where you could play anything, solo, duo, whatever. So one night I played the Candy Band. Monte Alexander said, babe, man, that was nice that you would do that for Sammy. So 1991, that thought occurred to me that if I ever had a chance, I was going to do it. When we went to record this date, I didn't even tell Joe Fields what I was doing. And after we started playing the People Tree, then Joe starts smiling. So that's why I took it upon myself to do something for Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah.
Because he had been completely ignored, you know. And I'm glad I did it. And I don't regret a day of it.
No.
Because he was a music genius. Nobody, Michael Jackson number two, Sammy number one, the greatest entertainer of all time.
I was about to say, I think he was the greatest entertainer of all time.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Okay. And once again, I've been talking with pianist, composer, educator, Mr. Hill Mayburn, and I really do appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and joining us here. But before I let you leave, are you working on anything new now?
Well, if I'm free to say just what happened, I have a new CD coming out on the Smoke Records, because we've been doing the countdown to Coltrane for the last 6 years, and we do 3 weeks. We did three straight weeks, 63 sets of music. And we guess artists, so that's probably going to be coming out soon. I'm sure Paul Stassen let you know. So that's probably going to be coming out within the next couple of months or so.
Okay.
Live and recording from Smoke.
Okay, and we're going to leave with another selection from your latest release, To Love and Be Loved. And I want you just to comment a little bit on this. It's Miles Davis, So What? Why did you pick that tune, man?
Well, Paul, here again, that was Paul Stassen's idea. He said, what about, you know, and he's great at programs. I said, good. This gave Nat Reeves a chance to show off a little bit.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's why he chose that, because the record has got a lot of variety on it, you know, and I did naturally one for my dear friend, Alfred McCoy Tyler, in a glimpse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think the record came out very well. And here again, with that record, we didn't have no rehearsals. Like I said, we are not geniuses or anything. This is just the way the music is. When you've been doing this for 66 years, you kind of have an idea about what to do, how to do it, and what will work, what won't work.
Or you should have one by that time, huh?
You should have one.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to leave. Once again, thank you. Thanks a lot, Mr. Hill Mayburn,
for
joining us.
Thank you.
And we're going to leave with the selection, So What, from his recording, To Love and Be Loved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's pianist Harold Mayburn from his latest release, 2017 release on Smoke Sessions Records, called To Love and Be Loved. Of course, that was the Miles Davis composition, So What? Featured Eric Alexander on the tenor sax, Freddie Hendrix on trumpet, Nat Reeves on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on the drums. And the weather for tonight, lows in the mid-50s. The chance of rain is 40%. On Thursday, rain until evening. Highs in the upper 50s, lows in the low 50s, and the chance of rain is 40%. And for Friday, foggy in the morning, highs in the upper 60s, lows in the upper 40s. And of course, keep your dial here. More great jazz coming your way on Return to the Source. But first, these messages.
This portion of our broadcast is made possible in part by James Bebe Morris of Woody Anderson Ford, providing new and pre-owned vehicles, sales, and leasing. Woody Anderson Ford is located at 2500 Jordan Lane in Huntsville and 1638 Hughes Road in Madison. For more information, James Bebe Morris at 256-990-4827.
Hi, this is Benny Colson. Did you know that April is Jazz Appreciation Month? Jazz is a uniquely American art form. It's just like the way we live. Learn the rules and express your individuality. Cooperate with your friends, but strut your stuff. So celebrate Jazz Appreciation Month. Attend a jazz concert, dance to jazz music, read a jazz poem, or just improvise with your friends. Jazz, made in America. Enjoyed worldwide.
Thank you.
That's music from tenor saxophonist Benny Golson from his 2004 recording called Terminal One. Of course, his classic composition, Killer Joe. Also featured Eddie Henderson on trumpet, Mike LaDon on piano, Buster Williams on bass, and Carl Allen on the drums, one of the students of Harold Mayburn. Of course, you're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. Keep your dial here. We'll be back with new music from bassist Corcoran Holt. But first, this message.
Alabama A&M University is a smoke-free campus. The policy prohibits smoking anywhere on university property and limits the use of smokeless tobacco products, including electronic or e-cigarettes. This applies to all students, faculty, staff, visitors, contractors, and subcontractors while on property owned or leased by Alabama A&M University at all times. The Department of Public Safety has further information at 256-372-5555. This is the public service announcement from WJAB FM.
Welcome to Return to the Source on WJAB from the campus of Alabama A&M University, 90.9.